What's up, ODs and eyewear lovers? We're talking the latest trends in tech and eye care, so sit back, relax, and defocus.
This podcast is in collaboration with Occutech.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Defocus Media Podcast. I'm Jennifer Lyerly, and I am joined by Dr. Daryl Glover, as always. How are you doing today, Daryl?
Jen, I'm doing great. It's just hard to believe that February's almost come to an end.
February, as you guys might know, is Low Vision Awareness Month, and as this month is wrapping up, I thought definitely no better person to speak on it and how important that is, not just in February, but every single day in patient care. So please welcome to the show, Dr. Henry Green.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Dr. Green, introduce yourself and a little bit about your background as an optometrist.
All right. Well, I am an optometrist. I graduated a long time ago, 1974, and went to school in Philadelphia. I lived in New York metropolitan area as a kid and went back to New York on graduation and realized that to be an optometrist in the New York area is a challenging thing to do. It's very hard to be noticed and hard to find a way to create a niche for yourself and get some attention. And I tried low vision care. I tried VT. I tried contact lenses. And it didn't take long for me to realize that low vision care was just a wonderful place to be. You know, we're taught in school that it's not low vision, it's slow vision. And it's like challenging that to do, and it's not remunerative. And I found out after not too long and after working with a gentleman by the name of George Hellinger, who was one of the real towers and powers in low vision back in the 70s, that low vision is easy to do. It's very rewarding, and it is a way to differentiate yourself from everybody else who's doing general optometry, and you get to develop lifelong relationships with your patients, and the loyalty that you get is just remarkable. And so it's been a nice trip for me in my career, and it allowed me to go off in different directions in terms of developing low vision devices and teaching what I've learned and just meeting lots of wonderful people all over the world, actually.
You know, I can really relate with you when you were talking about it's more of slow vision, because I actually did a rotation at the Pennsylvania College of Optometry in low vision. And those exams took a long time. And, you know, being an optometrist and getting out and having a lot of student debt, those are one of the factors that made me not actually jump into the world of low vision. Why should optometrists consider adding low vision as a part of their practice, especially if they have a high student loan debt? And we know that these exams could take a decent amount of time when we're examining these patients.
Well, you know, there's a saying, and it's probably not as true now as it used to be, and that is that if someone doesn't know how to do it clinically, they wind up teaching it.
Okay.
And when they're teaching it in school, they want you to become familiar with all the different kinds of products, and they want you to go through all of these tests. And so that you can become familiar with them and learn from them. In the same way, even in clinical optometry, you learn how to do ferometry and you learn how to do visual fields, but you don't do all of those things for all your patients. You do what's the appropriate thing.
Got it.
So when you did low vision in school, you thought that, gee, I have to do all this stuff for everybody? And the answer is no, you don't. It becomes very straightforward. When I teach, I try to explain to doctors that it's very straightforward to do, that there are distance vision activities, there are mid-range activities, and there are near-point activities. And folks who do a lot of low vision wind up using the same handful of equipment over and over again, maybe slightly different powers, slightly different approaches. But it doesn't have to be the long, drawn-out affair that you experience when you're in school. In my practice, I spent an hour with a low-vision patient, and it can be remunerative. You know, if you think of an ophthalmologist who's seeing 40, 50 patients a day, are they making a whole lot of money seeing those patients on office visits? No, they're not. What they're really doing is looking through all those 40 or 50 patients for the handful that will be surgical patients. And those are the ones that are remunerative and where they get their major procedure fees. So in the same way in low vision, if we prescribe a bioptic telescope or closed circuit TV or some sort of digital device, those are the procedures that's the equivalent to what a surgeon does in cataract surgery or whatever their specialty is. So you can't expect that every patient is going to get some expensive device. But if you were to expand that over the range of low vision patients that you're going to see, then it can be very remunerative. And even in my practice, which was a low vision specialty practice, only about 20% of my patients were low vision patients. I did general optometry, I did contact lenses, I did VT for a little while, but that was just never my thing. So you don't think that if you're going to do low vision, it has to be completely a low vision practice. So if you have slow times during the day where you're not seeing lots of general patients, that's the time when you'd schedule your low vision patients so that it doesn't compete or interfere with revenue that you get from your general practice patients.
Dr. Green, I'm intrigued because like Daryl, I think, you know, schools, whether not just, you know, one particular school, but we're talking about, we went to two different optometry schools and both of us kind of took away from like, huh, low vision, that seems a little bit daunting, but you're going to break it down to us into simple, straightforward steps so that all optometrists know they can get into this. So my first question for you is, how do you get started? Like, where should it begin if you're even thinking about adding low vision as a specialty?
Well, you know, I'm a visual learner, and we all have different learning modes, but I don't think you can learn low vision from a textbook. I think that the smartest thing to do is to find someone that's doing low vision who's competent, and that's important, and find a way to spend some time with them, a couple of half a days over the course of a month, and you watch how they do it, and you ask questions, and you see how they operate their practice and manage their patients. You know, when I see a low vision patient, 5 minutes into the exam, I pretty much know what all my options are, and it's the rest of the hour convincing the patient what the options are. So when we take a history from our patients, we ask them, we already know if they've got a central vision loss from macular degeneration or Stargardt's disease or some sort of developmental disorder like albinism or rod cone dystrophy. So we know pretty much by then what their visual issues are. And then we can organize our thinking into whether or not their visual goals are distance oriented, perhaps driving, if it's appropriate for their level of vision, or seeing signs, or seeing for traveling, or seeing faces in church, or seeing in a classroom, or reading activities, or computer screen activities, or perhaps mid-range activities for music or card playing if they're seniors. So once you can organize what their goals are in terms of distance activities, be it distance, mid-range, or near, it becomes quite obvious what your treatment options are. So to give you an example, for distance vision, we mortals only have three options. We can give them a better refraction, but if a refraction is going to make a big difference in somebody's vision, then somebody dropped the ball way before that patient got to somebody who's doing low vision. So it's rare that a refraction is going to make a big difference. And let's say someone's got 20/200 vision. If you change their prescription by a half a diopter, it's not going to put a dent in anything. But if they got 20/70 vision and you change it to half a diopter, it might give them 20/50 minus, and that they're going to notice. So you spend your time where you know you're going to get a return on your investment and effort. So number one, a prescription change might be appropriate for some individuals. Number two, the second option is to move closer. If you can't see something at 10 feet, then you move up to 5 feet and then you can see it. You've given the patient 2x magnification for free. So if they're watching TV from 20 feet away and you tell them to move up to 5 feet and now they can see the screen, that's 4x magnification. All it did was move a chair. But you can't always move close enough to see something. And that's where the third opportunity, which are telescopic devices and someday digital electronic devices, will be an option. And that's really my area of expertise is in bioptic telescopes, which are telescopes mounted onto eyeglasses. And my little firm, Ocutech, which was funded originally with grants from the National Eye Institute, allowed us to develop a new range of telescopic devices that are much easier to prescribe, take all the hassle and all the risk out of prescribing them, and have become really the gold standard of bioptic telescopes. So for distance vision, there are only three options. That really cleans it up and makes it easy to get your hands around, if you will. For reading, which is the other thing that most people are complaining about. Again, we really only have three options. We can give them stronger reading glasses. And by the way, if any of you are giving somebody higher than a 2.5 ad, if you're giving somebody, let's say, a 4 ad, so they can hold their reading material a little closer and get a little bit more magnification, you're already doing some low vision, aren't you? So number one is a stronger reading prescription. Number two is an optical magnifier of one sort or another, and they are usually helpful up to about 4x or 5x in power. Beyond that, the lenses are too narrow, there's too much distortion, the patients just don't find it convenient and easy to use, and they can't read fluently that way. So the third option, when they need higher amounts of magnification, are digital magnifiers. So it's either the closed-circuit TVs that are the digital version of the little microfiche readers that some of us who are old grew up with in libraries, or the version of a cell phone where you can take a picture of something and spread it and magnify it that way. And we even have electronic digital magnifiers now that I think, as they get a little less expensive in price, will probably replace optical magnifiers across the board. So pretty quickly, I've given you an approach to distance vision and near vision that pretty much puts it in some structure and organization for you. Now, mid-range is more challenging, and I think that will take another conversation or perhaps another time to deal with that, although there are compelling devices and approaches to that as well. I just don't want to dig in that deep at this point in time. I hope I didn't scare you off.
No, not at all. I do want to get a little bit, though, in your opinion, why is enhancing distance vision so important to your patient's quality of life? Because I get like reading patients looking at their pictures of family members, being able to write bills and checks. We know they need up-close reading vision. Why do you emphasize long distance vision so much in some of these patients when maybe their vision is 20/200 and we're not talking about really restoring functional legal driving vision without any sort of restriction?
So distance vision is a social sense. We use it to make eye contact, read body language, and feel connected with the world around us. And there's a growing body of evidence in the literature that says that loss of distance vision impacts quality of life in ways that loss of reading vision doesn't. You know, if you're having trouble reading, which is usually what they first complain about, we all know that, and I agree, there are plenty of ways to access the printed word rather than doing it yourself. You can get MP3 players, you can get text-to-speech converters, people can read to you, you can listen to the TV and the radio. So there are lots of ways to access print material without really doing it yourself. And frankly, if someone's going to be significantly visually impaired, like 20/200, as you say, which I no longer consider to be significantly visually impaired, pretty bad, but not terrible, because 20/200 is still quite easily manageable for most folks in low vision. However, even if someone has to read that material to me, it doesn't let me relate to the material. So for instance, if I want to see my granddaughter, so I'm a grandparent. If I want to see my granddaughter from across the room, nobody can see her for me. I have to want to be able to see her. And so that connection with the world around you is really a very important part of the social experience of distance vision. And so, as I said, there's a growing body of literature that says it leads to depression. There's even a study that just came out that says there's a correlation between loss of distance vision and cognitive decline, because people start to feel isolated, they start to restrict their visual activities, and then their general activities, and then they start to get more involuted and stop engaging with the world around them. So what people are concerned about when they lose vision is, am I going to be in the dark? Am I going to lose all of my vision? And the concept of that sort of isolation is very scary. Certainly understandably scary. So blindness is a very worrisome thing for most people, especially when they are not well informed about what the long-term prognosis of macular degeneration might be. So the first thing that all of us worry about is cancer. The second thing that most people worry about is blindness. And that's why it's so important for us to support the visual needs as well as the emotional needs and the adaptational needs of patients that are visually impaired. And as I said at the beginning, I think optometry is singularly in the right place to be able to provide those sorts of services.
You know, Jen, sometimes I think we do our patients a disservice, because it's been countless times I've had patients come in and, you know, they have wet macular degeneration and, you know, I'm asking them how they're doing and they're like, well, as long as I keep seeing my MD, they told me as long as I keep coming back, I'll have some vision. And then I'll ask them about low vision and they're like, oh, no one's ever told me about that. What is that? Can you tell me more about the services? Do you tend to run into that same problem in your practice as well, Jen? Or is that just in my world for the most part?
No, I mean, people aren't aware, and they are typically in this area, Daryl, where we practice, seeing an ophthalmologist for their care as they're getting into these advanced stages of vision loss. And there can be some miscommunication as far as what services are available to them because they're focusing on getting their injections, you know, every 3 months or however that is happening. So with that being said, I mean, how do you help grow and generate referrals for your practice and get the word out with what you're doing, Dr. Green?
Well, I wholeheartedly agree with what you just said. The most frequent thing that we hear in low vision practices, and that's not in my practice, but across the country and maybe even the world, when a low vision patient does come in and they get help is, how come no one has ever told me about low vision before? And it's a very frustrating reality that even after all these years, the referrals that are being made to low vision by ophthalmologists are just a drop in the bucket of the number of patients that need and deserve that care. Now, the standard of care in ophthalmology now is to make a referral for low vision services. And all of the ophthalmology training programs have to have a curriculum in vision rehabilitation. That's not necessarily to train ophthalmology residents to do low vision, but to help them understand that that's an appropriate referral and when to start making, to be thinking about making the referral, not when they're already 20/200 or legally blind. But as soon as a diagnosis is made, that it's going to lead to further visual reduction over time. Now, patients, of course, are looking for a cure. They're not looking for a device to help them see better. So at the beginning, they're going to go through the grief and denial stages and aren't going to be interested in what low vision can provide. But that doesn't mean they should not be made aware of that as an option down the line when and if they need it. You know, as I said before, the ophthalmologist is seeing 40 and 50 patients a day, and they're not really spending much time with each patient. And oftentimes it's the ophthalmologist's tech who spends much more time with the patient than the ophthalmologist does. And those are the ones that have to be recruited to make referrals for low vision. What the patient has to understand is that they need two eye doctors. They need their medical eye doctor who's going to treat their disease, and they need their vision eye doctor who's going to help them maximize the vision that they have. One doesn't do the other. Now, there's this perception among many patients that the retina ophthalmologist is the top rung of the ladder, and that if you're at the top rung of the ladder, you're an expert at all the things that are perceived to be lower on lower rungs on the ladder. And of course, we all know that's not true, that the specialist is a specialist in their niche, but not in other niches. Of course, the patient says, I'm already going to a specialist. What do I need another specialist for? And if they're senior and they have trouble getting places, then they depend upon others for transportation. They don't need to go to another place, or they don't think that it's necessary, or they don't want to be bothered with that. But the reality is that there's a enormous demand for more low vision optometrists, that there are not enough. And our company, Ocutech, is constantly getting calls from patients who have no low vision practitioner convenient to them. And so if a doctor, an optometrist, wants to practice low vision as a part of their practice, and they don't really know necessarily where they want to settle, they can call Ocutech or probably even other low vision device vendors and get some ideas of where there's a dearth of providers. And that might give them some insight as to where they might want to settle.
So Dr. Green, how do you go about building your practice to really get this off the ground and get those patients that so badly need your help actually in your exam chair?
Well, if you are referring patients to retina ophthalmologists, you need to reach out to them and ask them where they are referring their low vision patients. And if you hear a pause or then clearly they're not referring their low vision patients. And then you say to them, well, I think that I provide low vision services. I'm referring these patients to you. I think you should refer them to me. And matter of fact, all of your low vision patients to me. And I can send you a little information sheet about the low vision services that we provide, and provide information to your techs to provide to your patients. Because remember, the patients are not coming in asking to be in, to have another injection. They're saying, please save my vision. And you have to explain to them that I'm going to do everything I can to save your vision while Dr. Glover is going to provide low vision services for you to maximize the vision that you have. And we're going to work together to help you that way. Now, you can run ads until the cows come home and the phone won't ring off the hook. But if you can get a feature story in your local newspaper about a patient you were able to help with one sort of low vision device or another, and how that's changed the person's life, and you are the expert that made it happen, and that feature runs in the newspaper, your phone will ring off the hook. And that has happened to me, I cannot tell you how many times. If you do it for a kid with albinism who can now drive with a bioptic telescope, and that gets in the newspaper, your phone will ring off the hook. If you do it for Stargardt's, and this is now a patient that can see in the classroom or can keep a job or can now get to work and become a taxpayer rather than a beneficiary of social services, then that's a story worth telling. So the patients are in ophthalmology practices. The patients are in retirement centers. The patients are in self-help groups in communities, because there are self-help groups for visual impaired people in retirement centers, in large communities all over the U.S. And those are the places you want to visit to give a presentation and a hands-on demonstration. And those patients will knock on your door, I promise you that.
And how powerful is social media, like a Facebook group? I know we can see a lot of negative things in those groups for folks with low vision, but also if you actually run a story like this, I'm pretty sure you'll have the same impact. Are you using social media to promote your practice as well?
Well, I'm old enough to be your grandfather, so my expertise in social media is not that great. But Sarah, who is our social media person, will tell you that that is very, very important. And she's the one who does that work for us. And I know from the conversations that I see on the Stargardt's Facebook page that connecting with them is very, very well received.
Dr. Green, I want to circle back on something. You know, you touched on that your company only distributes low vision devices to optometrists, eye care professionals in general. How important is that to the Ocutech culture? And why is it that you guys do not participate on online sales to patients or consumers that are out there?
Well, first of all, Ocutech is an optometric firm. I'm an optometrist and I have a loyalty to my profession. And an optometry created the specialty of low vision care. So I have, you know, loyalties, a broad range of loyalty. Now, what makes low vision successful, whether it's an Ocutech bioptic telescope or somebody's electronic gadget or just stronger reading glasses, is the combination of the patient's goals, their capacity, their level of vision, and the expertise of the doctor who's going to get them from where they are to where they want to be. So when you order low vision devices online, and we know companies who do catalog sales, their complaint is that the patients, their return rate is enormously high. And the reason for that is that the patients really don't know what to order.
Right.
Patients are usually inappropriate and unrealistic, and no one's there to hold their hand and teach them how to use it appropriately. So the success of low vision is the combination of the right device for the right patient prescribed by the doctor that knows how to get the patient from A to Z. And our return rate on products is much, much less than 1%, because we support our doctors and our prescribers in the process of determining a prognosis for their patients, who to prescribe to and who not to prescribe to, and what to do if they do not have a good prognosis. So because I'm a clinician as well as a device developer, I'm sitting on both sides of the fence, and I can give our prescribers the advice they may need in order to figure out what to do for their patients. And I give advice not just for our products. I give advice for reading. I give advice for anything that a doctor would like some advice on. I've been doing this, as I said, for 40 years. I've probably made every mistake there is to make. And at least for myself, you learn much more from your mistakes than you do from your successes.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, you're just a wealth of knowledge. I could sit down and just listen to you all day. I mean, everything that you're saying is just gold to my ears. You know, one thing that I love is that you guys have great quality products, and that you are a clinician and you understand the optometrist point of view. One thing that I wanted to dive in also is, with low vision, it's not just about the products, right? It's also about going to the patient's business or going to their home and also setting up various things to enhance their quality of life there as well, correct?
I think that depending upon the needs of the individual, the environment, the impact of the environment is significant. So I don't any longer make home calls, but we have occupational therapists that we can refer to who will visit them in their home, who have expertise in vision rehab. So there are plenty of ways to address those issues. And your point about vocational support and classroom support is very well taken. You know, with the Americans with Disabilities Act, a lot of corporations will provide services and devices to their employees if that will help them in their job performance. And also in school settings, the IED, the Individual Educational Plan, the IEP, is designed to support the needs of special needs children, which would include optical devices or telescopic devices or electronic devices to help them maximize their academic potential. And there's certain nomenclature that you write in these recommendations that will force the school district to provide these services. So you learn how to provide those things. And we can talk about that at another time if you'd like. But the environment is very, very important. And when we do our evaluations on patients, we make certain to get them out of the exam room because, you know, for us, the exam room is the real world. But for the patients, it's not. So we evaluate them in outside, walking around in the waiting room, which is pretty close to a living room. We, you know, people have to go to the store and go marketing, and that can be a big challenge. So we have a shelf in our office with packages from the supermarket, and we can take them there and they can see what it's like to experience using equipment that can help them be independent in a commercial environment. And so the connecting their vision and their needs and to their goals is what this is all about. And while it may sound daunting, it gets pretty standardized pretty quickly. And so it doesn't take too long before you really know what you're about. And of course, for lots of patients, it comes down to driving. And of all the different kinds of care I've provided to patients through all my years, I have never had as positive response to being able to prescribe a telescopic device that allows an individual to drive. And they'll come back with tears in their eyes saying, "You've changed my life." And it's not so often you can hear that in any specialty, but we hear this all the time in low vision care, and that's worth something.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you know, I would love to learn more about this. I know you guys have an amazing webinar coming up on March 4th at 12:30 p.m. Can you just give us a little sneak peek or a preview of what you guys are going to be talking about with that webinar?
Yes. So this is designed for patients mostly who have either developed diseases in their senior years or born with visual impairments, with genetic disorders. And so myself and Dr. Janet Sunnis, who is an ophthalmologist and retina specialist from Baltimore, we'll both be on a webinar talking about the latest medical and genetic treatments for visual disorders. She'll talk about that, of course. And I will talk about the advances in assistive devices for visual impairment and how to establish a prognosis. And that's going to be running for about an hour and a half, something like that. And we'll have a short presentation at the beginning by Dr. Sunnis and myself. And then it will be a Q&A for the remaining time of the session where doctors and patients can call in to ask specific questions about their own situation, which we'll be happy to address. You know, I am now a member of the Stargardt's Facebook page. And it breaks my heart to hear the fears and lack of information that folks have access to in those sorts of environments. And they get worried about whether or not they're going to need to learn Braille, which is rarely relevant, or whether they're going to go totally blind and not see anything, and whether they're going to need a guide dog. So the lack of information that we see is can be really heartbreaking. So getting that information out to them, not only for Stargardt's patients, but for people who develop macular degeneration, who've known good vision all their lives, and now all of a sudden they perceive their life is caving into them, and how we can address that and give them the support they need so that they can better understand what's going on. And what I have found a lot of times in my career is just explaining things to them is enough to make them feel a whole lot better about their situation.
Well, Dr. Green, after this podcast, I'm pretty sure some folks that were on the border of thinking whether or not they were going to jump into the world of low vision, pretty much are going to start low vision at some point in time. What's the best way for them to get started?
Well, I would say that if you as a listener think that you might want to get involved with low vision, even at an entry level, let's say not at the highest level, and you don't quite know who to connect with, you can call Ocutech or you can call any one of the device vendors to say, who in my area is doing low vision that I could visit to spend some time with? And we're all happy to do that because we're all desperate to have more optometrists doing low vision care. Secondly, that feel comfortable finding someone that could be a mentor to you, be it a local optometrist doing low vision or myself via email or phone calls, and then go to some of the courses that and sessions that are being offered at meetings. There's a meeting called Envision, which will be at UAB in March, University of Alabama in March. And there's a big meeting in Southern California called CSUN, which has a lot of vendors of low vision aids there. And the sales people at the booths are usually very good at demonstrating their equipment. And they may not be too strong at teaching you how to evaluate your patients and establish a prognosis about what's right and appropriate for them. But nevertheless, it will give you the beginnings of understanding what's going on. So reach out, get some advice, get someone that you can talk to and be a mentee of, and you can take this very far, and it could be a very enriching and remunerative part of your practice.
And for those that want to speak to you specifically, do you have an email address or a social media handle that they can follow you on?
Yes. If my email is HG, my initials, at ocutech.com. And I do write a blog on the Ocutech website and talks about all the sorts of things that we've touched base on today, about how to do a low vision refraction, how to consider what telescope would be appropriate for an individual, how to establish a prognosis. You know, we just came out with the new Falcon autofocus telescope, which is really very exciting. I had a professor once who said that we prescribe adaptive devices, but it won't be the device that's doing the adapting, which means, of course, it's the patient.
Right.
And the more challenging it is for the patient to adapt, the less likely they're going to be successful with it. So what's the wonderful thing about our autofocus telescope, which is called the Falcon, is that it does the adapting for the patient. Wherever the patient looks, it's clear right away, just like normal vision. And it's quite a breakthrough. We designed one in the 1990s, which was very successful. And we couldn't any longer get some of the electronic subcomponents for it because technology evolves and things no longer become available. So we figured it was time to redesign that. And it took us much longer than we had expected to get it to fruition, but we finally are done with it. It's working very, very well. And it's a wonderful opportunity to provide a new range of services and function for our patients. And we've even found patients who were never successful with a manual focus device who are thriving with this because it's so much more natural to use. So there's new exciting technology coming up, not only at our firm, but in other manufacturers as well, that's going to make low vision care even more exciting in the years to come.
Well, Dr. Green, thank you again for being on the show. I know Jen and I learned so much from you, and we're really looking forward to this webinar. You guys, remember, the webinar is March 4th at 12:30 p.m. Hit the website, the companion post, and you'll see the free registration link to attend the webinar. You guys, make sure you show up. Thanks again, Dr. Green.
It's been a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much for the invitation.
Okay, it's a wrap. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to hang out with Defocus Media. We hope something resonated with you today. Please subscribe to our podcast and remember, we keep it 2020 around here, pun intended. We look forward to seeing you next time.